Well, brothers and sisters, we're ready to begin our first class. Our speaker is Brother Mark O'Grady, and the theme for Brother O'Grady's classes this week is Caleb, Giant of Faith. Today's class is entitled, Give Me This Mountain. The Mark.
Thank you, Brother Luke, and good morning, brothers and sisters. Well, finally this morning, Caleb receives his inheritance. It's a magnificent story. We're going to find that trust triumphs over tragedy. It's the mastery of faith over failure. You may recall we finished our last story with a brave man almost brought to his knees by a crushing disappointment as he finally realized that the faithlessness of his brethren had delayed his own personal inheritance and that of the nation for another 38 bitter years. His own personal journey is going to be extended by 38 more weary years. And now we suddenly come to the other end of that period of probation, and we're going to rejoice as a man receives his inheritance. It involves one of the most poignant interviews of all time, and we have the privilege this morning of standing there and participating in that particular interview. Now, it's not our task this morning to consider those 38 long, weary years in any detail, but we can't read the grim record without realizing that Caleb was there, experiencing all of those things, as God's terrible judgments on the nation were fulfilled. Numbers 14, "But as for you, your carcasses, they shall fall in the wilderness." And that sentence defined 4 decades of experience. So what do we have? We have about 1.5 million men, probably, or million people of that generation, thereabouts. Well, that's 110 people dying beside you every day. It includes the rebellion of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, the incident of the fiery serpents, the story of Baal Peor and the Moabites, the death of Miriam, of Aaron, and finally of Moses himself, plus long periods of nothingness. And slowly but surely, an entire generation wasted away in the wilderness, and Caleb was there. He walked alongside those people as it happened. Now, at the end of those 38 years, in Numbers 26, we won't turn it up, but God commanded Joshua and now Eleazar to number the children of Israel. When the numbering was complete, it was notable that there were only 2 people left of the entire generation who had been numbered earlier in the book of Numbers. You imagine being Caleb or Joshua, the only living remnant of an entire generation, living relics of the past. Now, if you'll come with me to Numbers, actually, no, we won't turn this up yet, but in Numbers 26, verse 51 to 56, one of the main purposes of the numbering was to set the scene for the allocation of the land by lot once they had entered it. First of all, they allocated the general tribal regions, and then they went through each individual family. Now, if we stop and think about it, that's actually quite a complex process. How do you allocate land out to every single family in Israel? It would have taken considerable time and quite complex administration. Who's to cast the lot? Who's going to be a witness? Who's going to manage the process to make sure that it's done with integrity, that each man, each family receives their appropriate inheritance? Who's going to record the results? A lot's riding upon this allocation process because it's going to establish inheritance and ownership rights for generations to come. It also needed to be done with faithful integrity because it needed to be done in a way that men would accept. So I'll ask you to come with me to Numbers 34. Because in Numbers 34, we find that there were men selected to form an inheritance allocation council. Picking up the record, Numbers 34, verse 16, Yahweh spake to Moses, saying, "These are the names of the men which shall divide the land unto you. It was headed up by the high priest, Eleazar the priest, and Joshua the son of Nun, and ye shall take one prince of every tribe to divide the land by inheritance. The word prince here is our same word Nazi that we came across with the 12 spies. And it's critical for the integrity of the process that these are men of the utmost integrity who will carry the trust of the nation. However, this time, the names of the men were picked by God himself. So he selects the representatives, the 10 names, to join together with Joshua and Eleazar as representatives of the 9.5 tribes left to receive their inheritance on the west of the River Jordan. So who would you select to be the first man on that list of tribal representatives? Who would you select to be the representative of the tribe of Judah? Who would you select to make sure that the entire process had integrity and a good clean smell so that the children of Israel would accept the results happily? Well, who else but our man Caleb? So in verse 19, the names of the men are these: of the tribe of Judah, Caleb the son of Jephunneh. Of all people in the land of Israel, he had the most direct linkage with that land. He had trodden upon that land. He had personally been promised an inheritance in that land. And he'd personally been commended by Yahweh as wholly following Yahweh his God. So in God's list of the appointment of the names, he's number one as a representative of the tribes. So whilst we might not hear anything about Caleb over those 38 long, weary years, we know this. He's still a prince. He's still a man of integrity. He's still prominent in the tribe of Judah. And his name is still synonymous with inheritance in the promised land. But it's when we turn to the book of Joshua that the name of Caleb comes to the fore again, true to character. He's older now, but he's still a courageous warrior, and he remains an outstanding example of faith. It's not until Joshua chapter 14 that we meet him again by name. But as we'll shortly see, his story is inextricably bound up with the events that take place earlier in the book. Now, the incident of Joshua 14 is referred to at least 4 places in Scripture. So it's clearly a very significant event. So let's turn up Joshua 14 now, and we'll just pick up the record very briefly. As we're going to see shortly, actually, it's this incident in Joshua 14 that completes the final phase of Joshua's original campaigns to conquer the land. From that point on, responsibility devolves upon each individual family, tribe first and then family, to go up and possess their individual inheritance. But the campaigns of Joshua are brought to a close by the events of this particular chapter. So let's have a brief look. Joshua 14, we won't go through this in any detail. We're going to come back to it shortly. But you'll note that in verses 6 through 15, Caleb comes to Joshua, reminds him of the events that had taken place 45 years earlier at the time of the spies, and he asks for permission to go and conquer and possess the region of Hebron. In verse 12, he says that he will deal with the giant Anakim. Now, I'd like you particularly to note the last statement in that chapter, the end of verse 15, and the land had rest from war. Now, we're going to find that little phrase is very helpful as a locking pin that shows us exactly where this chapter fits in the record of the campaigns of Joshua as a whole. This work brought the land to rest from that state of war. Now, of course, that's not complete cessation of all battles. We know from the book of Judges that they failed to complete the battle as individual tribes, but it brought to an end the major campaigns of war. Now turn over the page to chapter 15. Now, this is the allocation, as we see in verse 1, of the territory of Judah. And in verse 15, we read, verse 13, "And unto Caleb the son of Jephunneh he gave a part among the children of Judah, according to the commandment of Yahweh to Joshua, even the city of Arba, the father of Anak, which city is Hebron. and Caleb drove thence the three sons of Anak, Sheshai, and Ahiman, and Talmai, the children of Anak. And he went up thence to the inhabitants of Deba. All right, now come with me to Judges chapter 1. This is the third reference to this particular event. Book of Judges chapter 1, and we'll pick up the record in verse 9. Afterwards, the children of Judah went down to fight against the Canaanites that dwelt in the mountains and in the south and in the valley. And Judah went against the Canaanites that dwelt in Hebron. Now the name of Hebron before was Kirjath Arba, or the city of Arba. And they slew Sheshai and Ahiman and Talmai, and from thence he went against the inhabitants of Deba. It's exactly the same event, the same three named giants. Let's turn over the page. We find reference number four in verse 20. And they gave Hebron unto Caleb, as Moses said, and he expelled thence the three sons of Anak. So we've got four references to this battle of Caleb's at the city of Hebron. Now, to truly appreciate what takes place in Joshua chapter 14, we have to absolutely lock it in its rightful context within the book of Joshua. Now, we've made the statement that it was the final phase of Joshua's campaigns in the land. How do we know that? Well, first of all, we've got a very powerful clue in Joshua chapter 14. In fact, let's go back there. In verses 7 and 10, when Caleb explains that he's actually 40 years of age, he was 40 years of age when he spied out the land from Kadesh Barnea, that 45 years have now lapsed, and he tells us that he's now 85. Bear in mind that he was 38 when they left Egypt, and they crossed into the land 38 years after the spies incident in Kadesh Barnea. So Caleb was 38 when they left Egypt, 40 at the incident of the spies. He tells us that 45 years have gone by. He's now 85, and that tells us unequivocally, there's a 7-year period has lapsed now from when they first crossed over the River Jordan. And that 7-year period is the period of Joshua's major campaigns. Now come with me to Joshua chapter 11 and we'll see exactly where this battle fits into the record. Joshua 11, in fact, it's quite helpful to just get a bit of a structure for the book of Joshua because it's not exactly chronological. It does flow in a chronological sequence, but there are sections of the book which cover different topics. So there's a bit of backwards and forwards in them. So Joshua 11 verses 1 through to 15 describe the last of the three campaigns. That's the northern campaign. Then from verses 16 to 23, it moves into a final summary or summation of all of Joshua's campaigns. It describes the southern, the central, and the northern campaigns, and it includes the follow-up or the mop-up activities such as Caleb's at Hebron and Othniel's at Deba. Note, for example, in verse 16, it talks about him taking all the land from the south country, and by the time you get to verse 17, it's talking about Mount Hermon. So this is a description of all of the campaigns in total. When we get to verse 18, we find that Joshua made war a long time with all those kings. It's a summary. But note the words at the end of verse 23. And the land rested from war. Not that all conflict's over, but the major campaigns have now been completed. Now, to confirm that, look at verse 21. And at that time came Joshua and cut off the Anakim from the mountains, from Hebron and from Deba, from Anab and from all the mountains of Judah and from all the mountains of Israel. Joshua destroyed them utterly with their cities. There was none of the Anakim left in the land of the children of Israel, only in the territory of the Philistines. So that's why we can say that actually it was this campaign of Caleb's at Hebron that completed that work as he drove out the remnants of the Anakim. And so it's tied in with that little phrase at the end of the chapter there, and the land had rest from war. The reason why the Battle of Hebron is not described until chapter 14 is quite straightforward, because it's actually a description of Caleb's personal inheritance. And what we find is that actually those later chapters, from chapter 13 onwards, describes the allocation of the land to the individual tribes. So that's why Caleb's personal inheritance of Hebron is not described until chapter 14 and the verses that we've looked at. Now, what I'd like us to do at the moment, at this point, is just to step back and do a little bit of a detour, and let's look at those, as an overview, at those three major campaigns, because we're going to find that this is quite salient, it's quite relevant to Caleb conquering Hebron itself. As they crossed over the River Jordan, we know where they stopped first, the area of Gilgal. It was from Gilgal that they went out and they waged war, and each time they returned back to the area of Gilgal, and they actually camped there for these 7 years. And indeed, in Joshua 14, 7 years later, when Caleb goes to see Joshua, he actually comes to meet Joshua at Gilgal. That's where their base is still located. They started off with a central campaign, which is there in green, as they went across and they sacked the cities of Jericho and Ai, and then they ended up in an alliance with the area of Gibeon. So what you've got now, as they cross over the land, is they've established a bridgehead right in the center of the land. This is very rapidly followed by a southern campaign. And the reason for that is that it was forced on them by a coalition from Adonizedek, the king of Jerusalem. They went up against the cities of Gibeon. Then after that, we have the northern campaign, which I'll just move on to, which was forced on them again by a coalition from the king of Hazor away to the north. So let's look in a little bit more detail at the southern campaign. It was forced on them because Adonizedek, as soon as he heard of the alliance between Gibeon and the Israelites, was extremely dismayed. And so he formed an alliance with four other kings. There were five of them in total, and their intention was to go up and attack the area of Gibeon. So if we look on the map, and I've lost it here, but they head up. This is the suggested route as they went up to attack Gibeon up here. So it's Adonizedek, and he's got a coalition of kings from these various areas around here. And then overnight, there's a lightning raid as they march overnight from Gilgal, Joshua and his men, to relieve the siege of Gibeon. And we've got the very famous Battle of Beth Horon that takes place. So in Joshua chapter 10, if we have a look at Joshua chapter 10, and we pick up the record, we see that in verse 7, Joshua ascended from Gilgal, he and all the people of war with him, and all the mighty men of valor. And in verse 9, they came upon them suddenly, they went up from Gilgal all night, and they slew them with a great slaughter. It's one of the most extraordinary events in history, and it becomes referred to later in Scripture as being this amazing occasion when God changed the natural world at the request of man, because that's when Joshua asked for the sun and the moon to stand still for an extra 24 hours. The five enemy kings, as their armies were routed, they fled south all the way down here to the area of Makeda, and the five kings hid in a cave at Makeda where they were discovered, and they were cornered and trapped in there. In the meantime, Joshua tells them in verses 19 and 20 not to stop, but to continue to pursue their enemies, and he says, and look at the words carefully here, verse 19, stay ye not, but pursue after your enemies, smite the hindmost of them, and suffer them not to enter into their cities. Just note those words carefully. Don't enter into their cities. Verse 20, it came to pass when Joshua and the children of Israel had made an end of slaying them with a very great slaughter till they were consumed, that the rest that remained of them entered into fenced cities. Now, there's a difference between those two statements. don't let them get back to their cities. But there was a remnant who entered into fenced cities in that particular area. So if we put these verses together, we find that Joshua said, don't let them return home to their own cities, but there were a few who remained, and they escaped into fortified cities. Now note that, because it's going to become important for us shortly. Now up till this point, the process only took 2 days. The first day of battle, and then the additional God-given extension of light for the duration of about a whole day, it says in verse 13. Then in verse 21, the people return back to Joshua in this area of Makeda, down there towards the bottom of the screen. So where's Caleb? Well, it just so happens through all this process that Caleb is the head of the armed forces of Judah, the foremost, the largest of Israel's troops, tribal troops and fighting men. He's right in the thick of it. Now, we know that because in Joshua 14, verse 6, when it says that Judah came up to Joshua, Caleb speaks as the head of those armed forces. Not only that, in Judges 1, verse 9 to 11, I'm not sure if you noticed, but it described Judah coming up against Hebron. Whereas in Joshua, it describes Caleb as doing it. And we find that the two are used synonymously. What Caleb does, he does through the tribe of Judah. And what they do, they're led by Caleb in that particular battle. We also find from Judges 1 verse 2 that Judah was the first of the tribes to go up and conquer their individual areas. Well, that's not surprising, with a man like Caleb at their head. Now, Caleb is absolutely a warrior. I don't know if you've noticed in Joshua 14 how Caleb describes himself. If we go to Joshua 14 and verse 11, we find that Caleb describes himself. He says, I am yet as strong this day as I was in the day that Moses sent me. As my strength was then, even so is my strength now for war, both to go out and to come in. There's a reason why this man was repeatedly appointed as the prince of Judah for every difficult task. From the perilous spying foray into the land of Kadesh Barnea, to heading up the armed forces of Judah, to acting as Judah's representative on the Inheritance Allocation Council. He's still an outstanding man of war and a warrior of faith. But notice those little words, I'm strong for war, both to go out and come in. Have you heard that expression before? To go out and to come in. It's an expression that's used of two completely different occupations. Does anybody know what they are, by the way? A shepherd and a military general. Interesting combination. Shepherd warriors. It's a phrase that's used of the military generals of Israel, because not only did they lead their men out to war, but what was most important for their families? They brought them safely back home again afterwards. This is an expression used of the military general who headed up the tribe of Judah, who were all standing behind him as he's talking here to Joshua. All right, now, and we're just flicking backwards and forwards through these chapters a little bit. Just go back to Joshua chapter 10 now. This is the story of these five kings in the cave of Makeda. And in Joshua 10, Joshua does a rather curious thing. In verse 24, it came to pass they brought out those kings unto Joshua. But Joshua called for all the men of Israel and said, note these words carefully, he said unto the captains of the men of war, so that includes our friend Caleb, he says to the captains of the men of war which went with him, come near, put your feet upon the necks of these kings. And they came near and put their feet upon the necks of them. I suspect, brothers and sisters, as Caleb came forward, and as the captain of the man of war of Judah placed his feet personally on the necks of those kings, that he had ringing in his ears the words of their late beloved leader Moses on that fateful day 38 years earlier. Joshua here in verse 25 says to them, fear not, nor be dismayed. Be strong and of good courage, for thus shall Yahweh do to all your enemies against whom you fight. And 38 years earlier, Moses had said, "Dread not, neither be afraid of them. Yahweh, he shall fight for you." Deuteronomy 1 verses 29 to 30. And I suspect that Caleb in his own heart remembered his own words that he had spoken on that occasion when they'd pleaded with the people, "Neither fear ye the people of the land. Their bread for us, their defence is departed from them, and Yahweh is with us." Numbers 14 and verse 9. You know, brothers and sisters, consistent faithfulness and godly truth will always be vindicated by events. But sometimes it takes a long time. 38 years. God's timing is not ours. But can you imagine the thoughts in Caleb's mind as he sees these five mighty kings humbled in the dust, beneath their feet, crushed like the head of the serpent? "At last, I knew Yahweh would do this for us. I just had to wait." I like to imagine that the king whose neck he placed his foot on was Hoam, the king of Hebron. But with their enemies on the back foot at this point, they've just won this battle, Joshua is a brilliant, divinely directed general. So he loses no time in pressing home their advantage. And this battle's now followed by a lightning blitz as they run, race through the land, and they mop up each of the cities where those kings had come from. Now, I want you to note with me certain expressions. Verse 28, "And that day Joshua took Makeda." Verse 29, "He passed from Makeda to Libnah." Verse 31, "He passed from Libnah to Lachish and encamped against it." Verse 31, "He took it on the second day." Verse 34, "From Lachish Joshua passed unto Eglon." Verse 35, "And they took it on that day." You get the sense there's no pausing here for any other business. They didn't take the weekend off as it was. The moment they sacked one city, they moved on to the next. And their success is rapid. It's described as that day or the second day. So these are not protracted sieges or campaigns. Now, when you think about it, that's actually not surprising, because the kings and the cream of the armed forces of each of these cities has just been crushed and broken at the Battle of Beth Horon. So these cities are significantly weakened because they're undermanned. They've got no time to regroup. Joshua utterly wipes them out as God commands. And so the summary at the end of the chapter in verse 40, "Joshua smote all the country of the hills and of the south and of the vale and of the springs and all their kings. He left none remaining, but utterly destroyed all that breathed as Yahweh God of Israel commanded." And then at the end, in verse 42, it says, "And all these kings in their land did Joshua take at one time, because Yahweh, God of Israel, fought for Israel, and they returned to Gilgal." When it says at one time, it's the Hebrew word paam, P-A-A-M, and it means a stroke, a footfall, or a beat, or a currents. This is one mighty, crushing blow to the southern Canaanites who had gathered together against them. Speedy and brief. But you might ask, what's that got to do with our story of Caleb? Well, it just so happens that one of the cities they crushed in that southern campaign was the city of Hebron. Verse 36, "Joshua went up from Eglon and all Israel with him unto Hebron, and they fought against it, and they took it and smote it with the edge of the sword and the king thereof." So they must have appointed themselves a new leader. "And all the cities thereof, and all the souls that were therein, he left none remaining, according to all that he had done to Eglon, but destroyed it utterly, and all the souls that were therein." This is the city that featured so prominently in the spies' report at Kadesh Barnea. Hebron was the great fenced cities that the faithless spies had complained about. And in particular, the sons of the giant were there. So no doubt Caleb would have been centrally involved in this particular campaign in Joshua 10. But that creates a significant dilemma for us. The record here says very categorically, you can't misunderstand it, that the city was absolutely wiped out and there wasn't a soul left breathing in that city. And yet a few years later, in Joshua chapter 14, Caleb asks for Hebron. And we know from the record that it's later. And he says, Give me this mountain whereof Yahweh spake in that day. For thou heardest in that day how the Anakim were there, that the cities were great and fenced. If so be Yahweh will be with me, then I shall be able to drive them out. How can that be meaningful if the city's already been so meaningfully trashed back in Joshua chapter 10? It appears that actually in the intervening period, the city had been reoccupied, and Caleb had to come back and conquer the city of Hebron for a second time. That's the conclusion that most commentators come to here. Now, remember that little phrase in our earlier consideration of the southern campaign, the campaign where Hoam, the king of Hebron, was killed. The cream of his fighting men had been killed. But that little phrase in Joshua 10 verse 20 says the rest that remained entered into fenced cities. Now, remember, they're many kilometers from home. It's actually about 40 kilometers as the crow flies, the Battle of Beth Horon. So I suspect that Joshua went through Hebron and sacked it whilst those remaining men were still hiding in those fenced cities they had fled to at the end of that battle. And that would explain why the three sons of Anak, Talmai, Sheshai, and Ahiman, were not there back in Joshua 10, when Joshua killed everyone that breathed. But the same men are back there again in the city when Caleb takes it in chapter 14. Remember also, of course, that the city itself had been physically left intact. When they came into Jericho, they broke it down structurally. Actually, God did it for them. But they did the same with Ai. They did the same with Hatzor. There were a few cities they completely destroyed, but they deliberately left most of the cities intact. They were going to live in those cities in the future. And that was the case with Hebron. And after the battle, Joshua and the troops, they all returned to the area of Gilgal, and they've left those cities empty. And over time, over the 6 or 7 years, over time, scattered remnants come back into the city and repossess it. And we know from the record that that does include some of the sons of the giant. Reminds us a little bit, doesn't it, of the parable of the unclean spirit? He goes out and he comes back in and gathers 7 others, and they come back and join that mind again. So the walls are still intact, the families of the giants have returned, and Hebron is still a work in progress. It's been weakened, significantly weakened, by the destruction of many of its warriors, but it's still a mighty fenced city that needs to be retaken. Okay, that's the background. Let's go and have a look now at Joshua chapter 14 and stand there with Caleb as he asks for Hebron in Joshua chapter 14. It's a wonderful story, and it gives us an insight into the rich spiritual qualities of this man. We pick up the record in verse 6. The children of Judah come to Joshua in Gilgal, and Caleb comes up with the specific request for the location of Hebron as his inheritance. And can you imagine, Caleb comes up and he's got all the fighting men of Judah at his back. They love this man. They come in support of his request for Hebron. It's quite a delegation that Joshua received on that morning. Now, I'd like you to picture the scene as Caleb comes up and he stands there face to face with Joshua. These men are no strangers. They'd spied out the land together. Together they'd stood united against the entire nation as it was being swayed by the rebellion of the 10 spies. These are ancient comrades in arms, two mighty men of war, two warriors, two outstandingly faithful individuals. They've got an unshakable trust in God, and these two men are united together by circumstance, by values, and by a long shared history. I can imagine Joshua standing there as Caleb comes up and stands before him. Can you imagine those two, open face, looking deep into one another's eyes? There's an unspoken understanding between these two men, the two remnants of a past generation who shared so much together. Now, no doubt after some brief preliminary greetings, in the record, Caleb gets straight to the point. "You know," he says, looking straight at Joshua, "you know what Yahweh said unto Moses, the man of God, concerning me and thee in Kadesh Barnea." "We were both standing there, Joshua. We both heard it. We both saw it." Now, he doesn't ask Joshua, "Oh, do you remember if?" You would never forget those events. The recollection of those events 45 years before this particular occurrence, they were indelibly etched in the memories of those two faithful men. So he opens, "You know what Yahweh said." Verse 7, "40 years old was I when I spied out the land, and I brought him word again as it was in my heart." The NIV says, "I brought back a report according to my convictions." Then in verse 8 he says, "Nevertheless, my brethren that went up with me." Can you hear the pain in those words? 45 years later, "my brethren who went up with me." These were my brethren. They went up with me. They were traveling the same journey in the truth together with me. But they made the heart of the people melt. "But," says Caleb, "I wholly followed Yahweh." That phrase comes up three times in this chapter. Verse 8, verse 9, and verse 14. Verse 8 is Caleb's statement of conviction, not boasting, a quiet, simple statement of truth. "I wholly followed Yahweh." Verse 9 is a statement by Moses, "because you've wholly followed Yahweh." Verse 14 is the divine summation as Joshua and the elders give him that land, "because he wholly followed Yahweh, the God of Israel." Wouldn't it be magnificent, brothers and sisters, if the epitaph of that nature was given to us, the recaption of our life? Once we're gone, what people say about us: "That brother, that sister, she wholly followed Yahweh, the God of her people." That's a summation of a man's life. Now, I'd like you to carefully read with me verse 9, because these words are truly remarkable. "And Moses sware on that day, saying, surely the land whereon thy feet have trodden shall be thine inheritance and thy children's forever, because thou hast wholly followed Yahweh, my God." Where did the substantive record take place? Oh, we've seen it yesterday and the day before, way back in Numbers 14. We won't go there, we don't have time. In Numbers 14 is recorded that remarkable oath that Yahweh swore, "Truly I live," and he promised three things. Number one, the earth will be full of the glory of Yahweh. Number two, "and those men who provoke me will not see the land." And number three, "but my servant Caleb, him will I bring into the land, and his seed shall possess it." That's where the promise was made. So who swore the oath to him in Numbers 14? Yahweh. So here in Joshua 14 and verse 9, who's swearing the oath? Moses swore on that day. Do you know what this is? This is additional information that helps us understand more of what took place way back in that day in Numbers 14. Because in addition to what God said, Moses himself gave a personal commitment to Caleb. Note carefully the wording in verse 9. This is a personal statement of Moses. See what he says at the end? Because thou hast wholly followed Yahweh, my God. This is Moses speaking here. And when it says that Moses swear, it's the Hebrew word shabar. It means to take an oath. So in Numbers 14, we have Yahweh giving an oath. Here in the record, we have Moses giving an oath, swearing an oath to Caleb. And this tells us that in addition to what Yahweh has said, we have these words also of Moses. Now compare these two side by side. They're very similar, but there are some additional statements in Joshua chapter 14. Little details added by Moses which build upon the promise that Yahweh had made. Now, of course, these aren't at odds with the commands of God. This isn't Moses deciding, oh, I'll just add a few extra things. Everything Moses does is done under instruction and inspiration by God. I mean, the very next verse of this chapter in Joshua 14, in verse 10, says, Yahweh spake this word by Moses. And again in verse 12, whereof Yahweh spake in that day. So it's not that Moses is changing what God says, but the record is telling us that he swore his own personal oath to Caleb. So God uses that to extend and broaden out what's been promised to Caleb. So what are the additional elements? Now read those words carefully on the right-hand side and see if you can hear the echoes. All the land whereon thy feet have trodden shall be thine inheritance. What does that remind you of, brothers and sisters? Genesis 13 verse 17, arise, walk through the land in the length of it and in the breadth of it, for I will give it unto thee. Or what about the statement here on the right hand side? It shall be thine inheritance and thy children's forever. That's an exact reflection of the words of the promise made to Abraham in Genesis chapter 13 and verse 15. For all the land which thou seest, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed forever. And we know from the New Testament, Luke 1, Luke 20, Romans 5, Galatians 3, that that promise to Abram was a promise of eternal inheritance both to Abraham and to his seed. And it requires eternal life for Abraham. Brothers and sisters, Moses swore an oath to Caleb that both he and his children would inherit that land forever. Here is a Gentile, promised eternal life, promised the land as a direct inheritor of the promises of Abraham. Those words are nothing short of remarkable. This is a personal promise from Moses, because you've wholly followed Yahweh my God, said Moses. So in your mind, with that understanding, I'd like you to recast the picture we have of what took place when the spies returned to Kadesh Barnea. Caleb suffered that crushing blow. His personal loss and his disappointment for the nation would have been unbearable. So how did he cope? Moses saw it. He knew what it meant to this man. And you can imagine as the older man reaches out to Caleb, puts his hand on his shoulder and says, Caleb, here is my promise from Yahweh. That land you trod on, that land of Hebron from whence you bought those grapes, that land that you believe in, it's going to be given to you and your children for an everlasting possession forever. Isn't that remarkable? That's what gave Caleb the power to continue. That's what enabled him to overcome the disappointment, to faithfully continue on within the ecclesia of his day, to resolutely survive those 38 years and help the next generation in their conquest of the land to thee and thy seed forever. It's not about this life, brothers and sisters. It's not about the reversals of fortunes or the trials and tragedies that we experience. It's the eternal inheritance which keeps us going. That's the promise that God has given us. And a conviction of the truth of God's promise, that's what helps us to overcome trials in the meantime. Caleb never forgot those words, and he repeats them word for word 45 years later. And so he goes and he takes the city of Hebron. We're told that in Joshua chapter 14, that Joshua blessed him and gave him Hebron. And in verse 14, Caleb drove from thence the sons of Anak, and it became his inheritance. Now at this juncture, brothers and sisters, I'd like us to just reconsider again the stage process that we talked about earlier. Joshua had already overthrown the king of Hebron and their armed forces in the Battle of Beth Horon, swiftly followed by the southern campaign when they crushed and destroyed the armed forces when they sacked the city of Hebron and left none that breathed. Clearly, the defences of that city and its army had been significantly weakened. In Caleb's day, the sons of Anak are still there. They're back there again. They must have returned to the city in some way. Caleb still had to wage a mighty exploit of faith again as he overcomes the city. But the task had no doubt been made easier by the previous work of Joshua. The initial battle had been fought and won by his leader, Joshua. So what's the application for us? We have a battle to be fought. We fight a terrible foe. We fight the influence of this world. We fight it at work. We fight it sometimes in our relationships with our brothers and sisters, but always we're fighting that battle inside. We fight an insidious foe, our human nature. That's where the giants hide that we have to fight. Dearly beloved, I beseech you as strangers and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul. 1 Peter 2, verse 11. But thankfully, brothers and sisters, as we stand there grasping our weapons, and we stand with some apprehension in front of the walls of the mighty citadel that we need to fight, as we see those ferocious giants glaring down at us over the wall, we suddenly realize that Joshua, the captain of our salvation, has already been there before us. He's already slain its king. He's already broken the back of its power. In the words of Luke chapter 11, the power of sin is described as a strong man armed, keeping his palace. That's the king of Hebron, with his giants and his great fenced city in our lives. But a stronger than he has already come upon him and overtaken him and taken from him all his armor wherein he trusted and divided his spoil. Luke 11 verses 21 to 22. And in the words of Matthew, the parable is described that Christ's bound the strong man, spoiled his house and his goods. Our Lord's already overcome. He's already broken the power of the enemy. And now the responsibility on every generation is to faithfully continue on in that battle. And Caleb, 85 years of old, a representative of a previous generation, shows us how that battle should be done. Now, in our story this morning, Caleb, after 85 years of faithful service, a Gentile faithfully committed to the promises to Abraham, appears in front of Joshua, the captain of their salvation, to receive and ask for his inheritance. These two men were no strangers. They'd traveled the journey together all their lives. And as Joshua looked upon that faithful servant, he loved him, because he had wholly followed Yahweh. And he blessed him, and at long last granted him his inheritance. May it be, brothers and sisters, that when we finally stand before Yahushua, the captain of our salvation, he's not a stranger to us, nor us to him, because he's traveled with us in the journey and our battles, as we faithfully served in his army. May we too receive the blessing his lord said unto him, Well done, thou good and faithful servant. Enter thou into the joy of thy lord.